Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Listen for a report from Susan Shand. Then, learn English with our Ask a Teacher program. Finally, you'll hear our American Stories series. But first, this report.
This month, members of South Africa's Parliament will debate something on many people's minds: health care. They will decide the future of the National Health Insurance Bill. The bill's sponsors say their aim is to provide health care to all South Africans. Under the proposal, most health care would be free. It would pay for surgery, doctor visits, medicines, and hospital stays. Right now, only 15% of South Africans have health care insurance from private companies. The other 85% receive care from a struggling public health care system. That information comes from the government of South Africa. Supporters of the bill say it will bring justice and equality to the healthcare system in this deeply unequal country. But critics say the proposal is simply too costly and its goals unclear. They also note the government's inability to stop corruption and mismanagement in other projects. Bondile Masuku is a doctor. He recently was appointed to head the healthcare office in Gauteng, the South African province with the largest population. Masuku says the National Health Insurance Bill is a moral necessity. He said, "In a country like South Africa, with a culture of democracy that has to look after the people, the universal coverage is one way that we're going to do it." Johan Serfontein works in the health division of the Free Market Foundation. He describes the proposal as unrealistic. He said, "We've been at it for 10 years. We don't have enough clarity on how we want to do things now." But for patients like 25-year-old Kenisa Ntombini, anything is better than the current system. She has had many surgeries in public hospitals for her conditions, which include blindness. She says the public hospitals need all the help they can get. She said, "As a country, we will never be able to improve because we have this huge number of people who are unproductive and will forever be sick." She added that South Africa needs the NHI so rural and township hospitals can get more financing to improve people's health. Ntombini said she is very willing to put money into the system to ensure that everybody has quality health care. She said, "I think quality health care is like food, like shelter. It's something that everybody deserves to have." If Parliament passes the bill, the new health care system would be in place by 2026. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Evo Morales, Bolivia's first indigenous president, is seeking a fourth term in elections on Sunday. Some people in the South American nation have had enough of Morales. They have created memes that show him fighting forest fires with a child's water gun. Others put his image on pictures showing actors in the American movie Ghostbusters. Young people have used the memes to laugh at the 59-year-old leader and what they say is his slow reaction to thousands of forest fires. As the fires burned, Morales appeared in televised images, personally battling fires using firemen's equipment. The president's supporters say that showed how much he wants to protect Bolivia's forests. Yet many young people disagree. They say Morales has pushed to develop areas, leading to illegal fires that are used to clear the land. Young voters make up about a third of Bolivia's voting population. They could decide if Morales gets reelected. If the president would have acted before, we wouldn't be mourning so much loss or the death of so many animals. I'm reconsidering my vote, said 26-year-old Rolando Conduri. He cooks meals at his own fast food restaurant in the city of El Alto. Conduri says he has voted for Morales since he was 18 years old. But now he is listening to other candidates to see who can provide jobs and take care of the environment. These are said to be the top issues in the election campaign. Young Bolivians have been outraged by fires that destroyed an estimated 4 million hectares in the past 2 months. These fires received little international attention as the world reacted to the fires in Brazil's Amazon. Most of the fires have been in dry forests and farmland in the Chiquitania area of Santa Cruz province, although some affected the country's Amazon region. Before the fires, Morales had his triumph assured, said Marcelo Carpio. He is with a political science school called Leaders for Democracy and Development. Opponents have criticized a declaration by Morales' administration in July that permitted some controlled fires for agricultural purposes. They say it added to the environmental disaster. The government denies the fires resulted from the declaration. It says Bolivian farmers have cleared land with fires for years. In Morales' 14 years in office, poverty has dropped in South America's poorest country. The president still has large support, even among the young. To me, his reelection would be good for our Bolivia, said Alder Hermoso. He is an 18-year-old who dreams of playing European football professionally. Evo Morales will be a good president. But this support has been shrinking following corruption charges and Morales' decision to seek a fourth term. The Constitution limits presidents to 2 consecutive 5-year terms. In a special election, 51% of voters rejected a proposal to overturn the term limits. The courts later ruled in favor of Morales. Opinion surveys have shown that many young voters are undecided. These studies point to a competitive election. This is the first election with Mr. Morales in which the chance of him losing is real, said political observer Franklin Pareja. Morales is no longer fashionable, said Clara Huanca, a 21-year-old university student. She said he has failed to provide plans for improving education. Huanca also said that she became dissatisfied with Morales when he ignored the constitutional ban on serving more than two consecutive terms. I voted for Evo, she said. I was influenced by my parents, but now I'm completely against it. Many young Bolivians have no memories of a president other than Morales. Some say they are ready for change. But many young people are also unhappy with the opposing candidates. They include former President Carlos Mesa and lawmaker Oscar Ortiz. The presidential candidates have failed to understand the needs of young people, said Tony Lopez, a local expert in social networks. After 14 years in power, there is a lot of material out there to use to make fun of Morales, Lopez said. It's now in fashion to want to remove Evo from power, and many don't know why, said Edgar Totura, 19. I think it's because of what he said himself. I'll leave if I lose the referendum, and he hasn't done it. It's like he's laughing in our face. I'm Susan Shand.
This week, we answer a question from Nung. Nung writes, what is the difference between how do you feel and how are you? Dear Nung, thank you for writing us. The answer to your question depends on who is asking it and also who is answering it. It can depend on how well the two people know each other. How do you feel can be a question you ask a friend. It is a personal question about how you feel now. Let us say you are talking with your friend who just got out of the hospital.
Hi, Janet. I know you've been sick. How do you feel now? I hope you are better.
This phrase can be about how a person feels physically or emotionally. Like this question you may ask your friend who just got married.
How does it feel to be a married man?
Add ing and you get the word feeling. Now, you are asking how someone feels over a period of time. Here is an example.
How are you feeling since your foot surgery?
Or,
how have you been feeling since your father died last month?
You might also be asking someone her or his opinion.
How do you feel about the Nats baseball team playing in the World Series?
Let's turn to how are you? This is something friends also ask each other, but it can be a wider question, one that is not related to a specific issue, like this.
I haven't seen you for a while. How are you?
It is also a polite phrase you can use when you meet someone.
Sam, this is Elizabeth.
Nice to meet you, Elizabeth. How are you?
And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Ann Ball.
Next is our weekly program, American Stories.
Our story today is called The Boarded Window. It was written by Ambrose Bierce. Here is Shep O'Neill with the story.
In 1830, only a few miles away from what is now the great city of Cincinnati, Ohio, lay a huge and almost endless forest. The area had a few settlements established by people of the frontier. Many of them had already left the area for settlements further to the west, but among those remaining was a man who had been one of the first people to arrive there. He lived alone in a house of logs, surrounded on all sides by the great forest. He seemed a part of the darkness and silence of the forest, for no one had ever known him to smile or speak an unnecessary word. His simple needs were supplied by selling or trading the skins of wild animals in the town. His little log house had a single door. Directly opposite was a window. The window was boarded up. No one could remember a time when it was not. And no one knew why it had been closed. It surely was not because of the man's dislike of light and air. Sometimes he could be seen lying in the sun on his doorstep. I imagine there are few people living today who ever knew the secret of that window. But I am one, as you shall see. The man's name was said to be Murlock. He appeared to be 70 years old, but he was really 50. Something other than years had been the cause of his aging. His hair and long, full beard were white. His gray, lifeless eyes were sunken. His face was wrinkled. He was tall and thin, with drooping shoulders, like someone with many problems. I never saw him. These details I learned from my grandfather. He told me the man's story when I was a boy. He had known him when living nearby in that early day. One day, Murlock was found in his cabin, dead. It was not a time and place for medical examiners and newspapers. I suppose it was agreed that he had died from natural causes, or I should have been told and should remember. I know only that the body was buried near the cabin, next to the burial place of his wife. She had died so many years before him that local tradition noted very little of her existence. That closes the final part of this true story. Except for the incident that followed many years later. With a fearless spirit, I went to the place and got close enough to the ruined cabin to throw a stone against it. I ran away to avoid the ghost which every well-informed boy in the area knew haunted the spot. But there is an earlier part to this story, supplied by my grandfather. When Murlock built his cabin, he was young, strong, and full of hope. he began the hard work of creating a farm. He kept a gun, a rifle, for hunting to support himself. He had married a young woman in all ways worthy of his honest love and loyalty. She shared the dangers of life with a willing spirit and a light heart. There is no known record of her name or details about her. They loved each other and were happy. One day, Murlock returned from hunting in a deep part of the forest. He found his wife sick with fever and confusion. There was no doctor or neighbor within miles. She was in no condition to be left alone while he went to find help. So Murlock tried to take care of his wife and return her to good health. But at the end of the third day, she fell into unconsciousness and died. From what we know about a man like Murlock, we may try to imagine some of the details of the story told by my grandfather. When he was sure she was dead, Murlock had sense enough to remember that the dead must be prepared for burial. He made a mistake now and again while performing this special duty. He did certain things wrong, and others which he did correctly were done over and over again. He was surprised that he did not cry, surprised and a little ashamed. Surely it is unkind not to cry for the dead. "Tomorrow," he said out loud, "I shall have to make the coffin and dig the grave, and then I shall miss her when she is no longer in sight. But now, she is dead, of course. But it is all right. It must be all right somehow. Things cannot be as bad as they seem." He stood over the body of his wife in the disappearing light. He fixed the hair and made finishing touches to the rest. He did all of this without thinking, but with care. And still through his mind ran a feeling that all was right, that he should have her again as before, and everything would be explained. Murlock had no experience in deep sadness. His heart could not contain it all. His imagination could not understand it. He did not know he was so hard struck. That knowledge would come later and never leave. Deep sadness is an artist of powers that affects people in different ways. To one, it comes like the stroke of an arrow, shocking all the emotions to a sharper life. To another, it comes as the blow of a crushing strike. We may believe Murlock to have been affected that way. Soon after he had finished his work, he sank into a chair by the side of the table upon which the body lay. He noted how white his wife's face looked in the deepening darkness. He laid his arms upon the table's edge and dropped his face into them, tearless and very sleepy. At that moment, a long screaming sound came in through the open window. It was like the cry of a lost child in the far deep of the darkening forest, but the man did not move. He heard that unearthly cry upon his failing sense, again and nearer than before. Maybe it was a wild animal, or maybe it was a dream, for Murlock was asleep. Some Hours later, he awoke, lifted his head from his arms, and listened closely. He knew not why. There, in the black darkness by the side of the body, he remembered everything without a shock. He strained his eyes to see he knew not what. His senses were all alert. His breath was suspended. His blood was still as if to assist the silence. Who, what had awakened him, and where was it? Suddenly the table shook under his arms. At the same time he heard, or imagined he heard, a light, soft step, and then another. The sounds were as bare feet walking upon the floor. He was afraid beyond the power to cry out or move. He waited there in the darkness through what seemed like centuries of such fear. Fear as one may know, but yet live to tell. He tried, but failed to speak the dead woman's name. He tried, but failed to stretch his hand across the table to learn if she was there. His throat was powerless. His arms and hands were like lead. Then something most frightful happened. It seemed as if a heavy body was thrown against the table with a force that pushed against his chest. At the same time, he heard and felt the fall of something upon the floor. It was so violent a crash that the whole house shook. A fight followed, and a confusion of sounds impossible to describe. Murlock had risen to his feet. Extreme fear had caused him to lose control of his senses. He threw his hands upon the table. Nothing was there. There is a point at which fear may turn to insanity, and insanity incites to action. With no definite plan and acting like a madman, Murlock ran quickly to the wall. He seized his loaded rifle and, without aim, fired it. The flash from the rifle hit the room with a clear brightness. He saw a huge, fierce panther dragging the dead woman toward the window. The wild animal's teeth were fixed on her throat. Then there was darkness, blacker than before. And silence. When he returned to consciousness, the sun was high, and the forest was filled with the sounds of singing birds. The body lay near the window, where the animal had left it when frightened away by the light and sound of the rifle. The clothing was ruined. The long hair was in disorder. The arms and legs lay in a careless way, and a pool of blood flowed from the horribly torn throat. The ribbon he had used to tie the wrists was broken. The hands were tightly closed, and between the teeth was a piece of the animal's ear.
And that's our program for today. I'm Mario Ritter Jr. Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program from the Voice of America. And find more stories, activities, and videos on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.